I cracked an eye and looked down into the sand to see a little dog that had once been frosty white and trimmed round as its name. Hey folks, greetings, how you doing? Keith Tyler here, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Pleased and honored that you decided to tune in today. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine brings us our first story by the author Pete Barnstrom. It's called Beach Dog. The hammock, having proven itself of uncommon comfort, what with it being in good shade and within earshot of tidal rhythms, I could not tell you how late in the day it was when the touch of a cold nose on my dangling foot startled me from my slumber. It would not be early. I cracked an eye and looked down into the sand to see a little dog that had once been frosty white and trimmed round as its name. But it had been a spell since the poor girl had visited the dog barber, and it showed. Something I'll call mud clung to her like she'd been rolling in it, and her smell suggested a rotten fish might have been involved. "Hey, howdy, Snowball," I said. Snowball said nothing intelligible, as was her wont, but instead looked up at me like the lapdog she was and emitted a sharp, short sound that was plumb pitiful. But it was a mite toasty for me to pull her up into my hammock, so instead I slung my legs around so I could sit and look down at her while we caught up. I patted her on the head, but without enthusiasm. That stink she had on her was noteworthy. "Where's your mama, little pup, and how come she hasn't given you a bath?" Snowball was charitable enough not to ask when last I'd seen a shower, but I was at least capable of my own wash-up. What was the woman's name? They came and left so quickly, the tourists. But I used to be good at names. Marge. Margot? Margaret? Nah. There stood a beer bottle in the sand next to the little fluffer, and I realized it was probably I who left it there when I took my leisure between the trees some hours prior. It was the local brew, skunky and warm, but not empty, so I extracted it and tilted the sandy end skyward over my lips. When had I last seen Snowball? For a moment I attempted to tally, but it was early in the afternoon for such mental exertions, so I let it go at a month or two. That was too long, I reckoned, and not because I had missed her canine company. It was the women, always the women. The men, they didn't really care about bringing a pet along, but there was a flavor of woman who always had to have her little fur baby. The official line from local government, well, such as it was, said that animals from the mainland were not welcome on the sovereign maybe democracy that was our little island. As I understood it, there had been a rabies outbreak decades ago, long before my hat got hung here, and they'd elected not to chance it again. But tourists had money to blow, their beloved pets kept in stir across 3.5 miles of sea, and I had semi-regular access to Dr. Felden's seaplane. Even I could calculate that sum, and what it amounted to was a modest income stream for the local dog smuggler. Part of the deal was that I'd have to sneak the puppers back, of course, once the tourists had gotten their fill of golden beaches, couples massages, and fruity cocktails. Which is why it struck me as downright peculiar to find Snowball here for so long after we'd made our little trip, and without her owner lady in tow, Maggie? Myrna. She wouldn't have taken off and left you, I told the dog, and on that I do believe Snowball and I were in accord. What's more, it's a rare tourist lady indeed who is here more than a week or two, much less months. I tried to remember if Madeline had a husband in tow. Seemed likely, but I could not be certain. No, not Madeline either. Monique. Ah. My bottle was empty, so I craned myself up off the hammock into my old boat shoes, more holes than hole, into the rusty bicycle canted against the palm tree. I didn't figure Snowball for keeping up, so I put her in the wire basket in front of my handlebars and on top of the empty bottle. Had to get my nickel back. The narrow and weedy crushed shell roads were barely preferable to riding on the sand, but I made it to the big hotel. There was other lodging available, but mostly for kids with backpacks and other wanting the authentic island experience. As those sorts tend to be of the cheapskate variety and thus less likely to hire my services, I opted to start at the top. I rested my bike against the giant cement conch shell on the manicured lawn and walked into the lobby with a filthy little purse dog under my arm. The woman behind the marble-looking counter just inside said, "You know we do not allow animals in this establishment, Charlie." Her name was Agatha, and she was as bright and slender and sweet as a sugarcane tassel, and so she got on to be the front desk and wear an apricot scarf over her thick braids. Then she slanted her big brown eyes down and said, "And that goes for your dog, too." Agatha and I had a bit of a history, and there were moments when I suspected she held it against me. I went to the closed door at the end of the counter and tried the handle. It turned easily, so I elected not to wait for permission to enter. Theodora looked up at me from her desk and pronounced my name with rather more fondness. I was well acquainted with the island accent, of course, but hers possessed a musical lilt that I found, oh, most appealing. She was as stout as Agatha was slight, and a good bit older, but she was tall enough that she could look down at the top of my head, which she likely had done more than once, seeing as the two of us also had a history. Its ending was of a more amicable nature, and she graced me with one of her best smiles. Then her nose wrinkled, and she said, "Whew, about time to turn the hose on you, boy." There is a long tradition to the alibi, but on this occasion, it was accurate. I showed her Snowball, and I said, "Not me. It's the dog." Theodora said, "And what do you think you're going to do in here with that little mongrel, Charlie Ash?" She didn't have time to get up and around the desk before I snaked my way across the room to his door. "Snowball is no mongrel," I assured her. "Purebred marshmallow terrier." And as I closed the door behind me and was in the windowed and dark-paneled presence of my old buddy Eves, the hotel manager, he did not seem delighted to see me. In fact, he barely looked up from the papers on the desk. "Go away, Charlie. Just so you are aware, I returned those towels last week. You may inquire at the laundry room. Go away. And I'm not here to use the pool. Leave. I only dropped round to see if you recognize this." I lifted Snowball out in front of me. She seemed accustomed to being put on display. Eves looked up, then blinked back in a motion one could best describe as recoil. "What have you done to that dog?" "Well, I believe a period living rough on the beach is what did this little fuzz bucket," I told him. "I have reason to believe she's been here more than a month." He knew why I would know. He got his kickbacks from the hotel guests, too. "To whom does it belong?" Eves always got grammatical when annoyed. I heard it a lot from him. "Well, that's why I'm here," I said. Snowball interrupted me in my deepest meditation, and I do believe she was asking for assistance. "I'd like to reunite her with her human." There was a call to Theodora into the deliberations, and as she had access to files and also was smarter than the two of us in unison, we narrowed it down to a week, well, then a day, or two, and finally Theodora announced Schmidt, which seemed to be a name. Mr. and Mrs. Jacques Schmidt. Jacques Schmidt? I'd have wondered aloud how they got passports with so obvious a false name had I not been in the presence of individuals who accepted that identification for a hotel reservation. Checked out 31 July 1984, Eve said, which made sense. A Friday night before the start of hurricane season, which, when most everyone else checks out. And here it was, end of September. He put the file on his desk and pointed at the photostat of their registration form. I saw a tidy signature, Mrs. Jacques Schmidt. Oh, they spent time at the pool bar as well, Theodore said, and placed that card with it. Signed off their tab on the same date as checkout. I looked closer. Same name, different signature. Theodora leaned in. It says Mrs. Jacques Schmidt. The wife, Eve supplied helpfully. You think? I rubbed my nose and instantly regretted it. Snowball's reek had been persistent on my fingers. What woman signs her husband's name these days? I thought about the woman who had hired me to get Snowball. No kid, but she wasn't a 50s housefrau either. Some traditions are quite admirable, Eve said, but the look Theodora gave him suggested that she might disagree. You got a home address for them? He looked and came up with one that claimed to be from a place with a patently bogus name of Townsville, Kansas. Pair that with the name, and I believe I was not being rash when I told them that they'd been hoodwinked. Then they both looked at me, and I said, What? It is not uncommon that couples are less than, well, truthful when checking into hotels, Eves informed me, especially couples that might or might not be actually married. Oh, right. We endeavor to be discreet. Oh, of course you do. I looked back down at the papers on the desk, only in part because their glares bordered on withering. Paid in cash, I presume? They had, and seeing as I had come all this way for nothing, or near as much, I stopped in at the bar on my way out. It's a nice bar, better than mine. Of course, mine's just a shack with no stools or live music or even glassware. But it's a shack on the beach, which meant I had the better view. Still, I liked their bar. Swinging stools, right out of the pool, and a little wall where they'd serve you when you swim up. I leaned against the counter inside and let Yasiel prepare for me one of his specials. Grain alcohol and sugary ice slush from a machine that operated on such a broad margin that he could afford to give them out free. To me, not to everyone. There was a bowl of plantain chips, and I had him dump it out and spray some club soda into it. Then I put the dog up on the painted tiles, and she drank. And Yasiel said, Snowball? Oh, you're familiar with his dog? Ah, you bet. Used to come in here a lot. Haven't seen in a while, though. Yasiel patted her flank while she lapped at the water, and I hoped he had a place to wash his hands back there. I don't suppose you can recollect the party who escorted her here? I slipped the micellary slow to forestall a headache. A woman, perhaps. Oh, Meredith? Yeah, sure, you bet. Meredith. Well, I'd been close. If it was a snake, as the expression had it. This being rather a busy place, even now in the off-season, I asked him how it was that he remembered a client almost 2 months back. He pointed at the dog. Not every customer brings in a little white snow dog. No denying. Is that all? Well, Meredith was a good tipper, too, you bet. She signed for her tab, but also paid it in cash. Just for us. 100% tip, I nodded. Well, that's passing generous, I would say. Very nice lady, he said. You bet. Beyond nice, in fact. Ostentatious might be the term I'd employ. I wondered why it was that she wanted people to remember her, seeing as she arrived here under a fraudulent name. Somehow the hours eluded me, and I observed a number of empty glasses on the counter in front of me. The lights came on in the pool. At some point in the proceedings, I saw Corrales enter the bar. Or more accurately, smelled her. The scent of that basket of hers was all the advertising she needed. Even at the end of the day, freshly baked bread sells itself. She stopped at various tables, and the brave off-season travelers bought her wares. A few chewed her ear for a moment, and I knew they were arranging delivery out at the archipelago. The archipelago was a walled-off domain at the far end of the island with the big houses, privately owned, but some renting out during the off-season. I'd go there on a regular, visiting Dr. Felden, or more often, the good Dr. Seaplane. Corrales made her mint, delivering fresh bread in the morning to the houses out there, and then came to the hotel bar to get rid of the rest at night. Fresh baked was fresh baked, even after dark. When she got to me, I bought a long and knobby loaf, and with it ordered a bowl of house curry. I was going to need something to soak up this alcohol. Like Yaseel before her, Corrales not only spoke to Snowball, but addressed her by name. It was a challenge speaking past cheeks filled with crusty bread, but I managed.
How is it you come to know Snowball here?
Corrales rubbed the dog's head and looked at her while answering me.
Her lady orders my bread.
Orders? Mine was a second language to Corrales, and I wondered if the verb tense was accurate. To her room?
No. Corrales said, still to the dog, the mornings.
You mean out to the archipelago? She nodded, tousling Snowball's matted curls. I asked her which house, and she told me it was the Tortugas. Well, each house was named for an island. Dr. Felden's was called Easter. That may be ironic for a person of the Jewish persuasion, but if I'm honest, I must admit I don't fully know what irony means anymore, which could be as ironic in itself. I finished the curry, leaving a bit of goat meat for Snowball and half of the bread for Yaseel, along with some currency. I didn't pay for my drinks, as I knew he had neglected to charge for them, but that was ever more reason to provide him with a little compensation for time and effort. He knew he'd be similarly treated next time he stopped by my bar after snorkeling the reef. My bicycle still leaned out front, but so close was the white Jeep that I had to heft it over to the hood to saddle up. Snowball, being a dog of discernment, waited patiently on the moonlit lawn. She knew a good thing when it carried and fed her. There were not much more than a dozen automobiles on the island. Some trucks for delivery, and the local police had a pair. Golf carts at the dive shop and the hotel for housekeeping, not golf. The rest of us rode the Ankle Express, or bikes. But rich people, as they say, are different. And so the archipelago provided a white Jeep for each of their properties. And seeing as there aren't many night spots on the island, if they want a night out, where they come is the hotel bar. And leave their vehicles wherever the heck they manage to apply the parking brake, it would seem. The island isn't too big. Only took me a few minutes to bike to the archipelago. The guards just nodded as I entered. They were used to seeing me coming through there, especially with a dog in my front basket. Dr. Felden's plane was docked there, and my sideline as a facilitator of canine reunion wasn't exactly a secret. The going became considerably harder once I was inside the walls, though. This was the hilly end of the island, and each house was designed to have a nice, unspoiled view of the blue Carib. That meant that they were sitting one after another up the rocky crags. I'd lather up a mighty sweat by the time I got myself pedaled up to the path to Tortugas. I found it between Madagascar and Baffin, geographically confusing though that may be.
The door was tall enough to bring to mind that old King Kong movie, and I rode my bike right up to it and lifted the knocker that was as big as my head. The echo was distinct even from the outside. I saw shadowed movement in the wavy amber glass on either side of the door, and then it clicked and swung open with a disappointing silence. A door that big deserves a timpani roll. The face I saw inside of it brought it all back to me. Her hair had been darker then, and her complexion less so, but a few months on the island will do both of those for you. She also looked like she might have put on a pound or two, but bread delivered daily by Corrales would do that for you, too. Meredith, I said and gave her a grin. How nice to see you again. I'll bet you've been missing somebody. And I picked up Snowball from my bike's basket. Meredith did not seem pleased. Bring the bike inside, she told me as she turned away from the door. I don't want the neighbor seeing it. That seemed a bit harsh. I would be the first to admit that my wheeled steed had its blemishes, what with the salt air and errant jeeps, but that comes with the milieu, as it were. Still, I wheeled it in, Snowball under my arm. Nice place. Got dark when she pulled the doors to, and I nearly stumbled on a stone half-step down into the main room. There were shutters on the far wall as big as the door, and when both ends were opened, there'd be a breeze in here you could fly a kite to. But who closed them? Not with that view. Even in the night, I could make out the edge of the horizon and a hint of a storm in the distance, lightning tickling the waves. It was the smack-dab middle of hurricane season, officially, but we'd been more or less unmolested that year. Just lucky, I guess. It was the true devil fighting you, I told her, still looking out, bicycle handlebars all but forgotten in my hand. That likely had something to do with how you signed at the hotel. May I presume your name isn't really Schmidt? I turned back to her to reveal the innocent sport in my expression, and that's when I noticed she was holding a pistol. It was a revolver, big, of any sort they used in a war prior to mine. It looked no less lethal for its age. Is that loaded? How much do you know? There was a pale under her tan, mostly around the nose, and deep lines ridged the side of her mouth. Did they find Herbert? Herbert? Who's that? No, I said, lifting the dog again. I found Snowball. Did you tell anyone? Her eyes darted from side to side, thinking or maybe looking for menace in the shadows of the room. How much do they know? If someone to testify, I told her, I would swear on a stack of Bibles that nobody knows anything, me least of all. Stupid has always been my philosophy. My eyes were on the barrel of that hog leg in her hand. What caliber was it? Looked capacious enough to sheath a pickled cucumber. Could I impose upon you to tuck that away somewheres? How did you find me? I left the island. I made sure everyone knew I left the island. Ah, all the extravagant displays at the hotel. Those were to make sure the staff would take note when she was gone. The free spending, the gifts, the good hours at the pool bar. The dog. She'd sent me to get the dog, and that they'd remembered the dog lady, but not the lady once she was rid of the dog. Did she even care about Snowball? Oh, I should have hidden him better, she was muttering. I should have dropped him in the sinkhole. I should have fed him to the hogs. Still on about Herbert, I presumed, whoever that was. She was between me and that big door she'd closed. I could vault the sill for the other side of the open shutters, but I was pretty sure it was just cliff face out there and the fall would be precipitous. Where it wasn't rocky. What a lovely room, I managed to say. I witnessed heated passion assuaged by a gentle word, and I didn't guess it hurt to try. Did you decorate it yourself?
Her eyes snapped back at me.
I could not swear that she blinked since I got here.
Shut up, you!
As a tactic, the gentle word method is not infallible. I should just go.
Nope,
she said. You've seen too much.
That's just my world-weary air, I assured her.
I'm really quite the ignoramus. The goat curry was heavy in my belly. She lifted her hand at me.
Too much, she said, and I saw her fingers begin to tighten inside the trigger guard.
I tossed the dog to her.
Whatever one's feelings for good old Snowball, you see a flailing ball of tiny canine flying at you, you either get out of the way or you catch.
She chose to catch, which pleased me, and not just because I'd have hated to see Snowball hit the stone floor. More of the essence was the fact that, at least for a moment, that rocket launcher of a pistol was directed elsewhere. My hand dropped, fell into the basket on my handlebars, something there smooth, rounded. I closed on it, brought it up, and flung it right at Meredith's face.
It was my beer bottle from when Snowball had initially approached me that afternoon. It struck the woman between her rolling eyes and bounced off without shattering, but she went back frightful hard.
I sprang into action, and my legs promptly snared with my bicycle, and the whole tangle of us commenced to fall on top of her. My stint as an enlisted man was hardly what you'd call battle-hardened. I was a mechanic for the 1st Aviation Brigade at Long Bin Post. We had bars and restaurants there. I never faced an enemy fiercer than Vapor Lock on a 260 horsepower Continental IO 520F engine, and although I went through basic, anything it taught me about hand-to-hand combat left my head when I turned in my boots. Turns out I didn't need to know much, because by this time I found the dropped pistol under a nearby end table. I could see that Meredith's head had hit the stone step. I almost tripped down, and her eyes weren't rolling anymore. Snowball was barking. I told her to shush. But she was of no mind to silence. I couldn't blame her. I wanted to scream myself, but the neighbors, while not directly on top of us, could not have been far and undoubtedly had their shutters open as well. So I picked Snowball off the tiles and stroked her nasty little head until she quieted. Such respite also allowed my nerves time to cease their jangle. Meanwhile, I occupied myself with thought. Herbert? Who was this Herbert? Someone here? In the house? Well, didn't seem likely the way she was talking about him, but I poked around looking in every room and closet. No evidence of a man or even another person. Only one toothbrush in the cabinet above the bathroom sink. That seemed significant. So who was she? The mythical Mrs. Schmidt, or someone she left stateside from whom she came here on a run? And was he going to turn up someplace where he'd draw attention? Not my problem. My problem was the former Meredith cooling in the main room. Almost certainly she had kept her profile low while in the archipelago. She wanted people to forget her. Seemed unlikely anyone would come around looking for her and find a dead body. But there was the issue of smell, and Corrales delivering her baked goods, the body would be discovered. Even if she lived on the down low, people around here knew me. That much was certain. Should any dots be connected, it's just possible they would lead to my favorite me. And I decided it would be in my best interest to leave no dots. I found her Jeep out on the side door. Top was already down and partly hidden by the rocky outcroppings this place was built around. I was able to get her in the back, but not without effort. While I had never before considered whence came the term dead weight, I would learn what it meant that starlit night. The keys were in the Jeep. No one worried about theft up here, not with those walls and guards.
guards who barely paid attention when I rode through. I got lucky with the keys, but not with the battery. She didn't get around much, and it had died. I let out the handbrake and started it coasting down the hill I'd biked up, and the second time I popped the clutch, it started. Not sure what I'd have done if it hadn't. That would have been unfortunate. Snowball was in the passenger seat, not looking at me. I could hardly blame the dog. "Sorry I chugged you at that crazy lady," I told her. Hard to guess if it made a difference to Snowball, but my apology was heartfelt. Dr. Felden's place was empty this time of year. The good doc jetted away to a New York cardiology practice during the off-season, flying commercial because her little Cessna TU-206 Gulf would find a journey to that distance to be challenging. I had been appointed official mechanic for the plane, keeping it in condition for her jaunts about this and nearby islands, where she provided top-notch medical care to the residents pro bono. Good woman, Dr. Felden. What that meant this night was that no one asked questions when her seaplane went flying off, in this case with two passengers, one of them being Snowball. I would return with only Snowball. Meredith I left out in the Straits to feed the fish. Not a bad funeral, burial at sea. Noble, some would say. The U.S. Navy, for instance, or Vikings, or, you know, whales. Her pistol was on the floor beside me. It wasn't as big now that I observed it from a decidedly less vulnerable angle, but no good could come from having it around. I tossed it in after her. Everything back in its proper place, I biked my way out of the archipelago with Snowball in my basket, again next to that beer bottle. I'd get my nickel back yet. It was still dark when I got to my bar at the beach, and the little dog and I sat on the hammock to watch the tide roll until the sky lightened. Sunrise was on the opposite side of the island. That's why the hotels were over there. Tosh came down the beach kicking his ratty soccer ball. He's the reason a displaced Texan beach crawler is allowed to make a home here. I'm an employer. He's my official bartender. When I'm otherwise occupied, usually in the hammock. I paid him a little, but he didn't need much. He did okay for a 12-year-old. When he saw the dog, he forgot the ball and ran to us. He put his face right into Snowball's, oh, fluffy fur, and made kissy noises. Oh. "What's his name?" he asked. I corrected him as to the issue of gender and then started on a name, but stopped. I realized Tosh probably didn't know from snow, having grown up here, where the temperature never got much below that of a healthy body. Could be the church showed movies around Christmas time. Well, hard to say. So instead I told him I didn't know. "You give her one," I said. I guess he did. I still see the two of them running around together today. A boy needs a dog. Alright, I've switched over to the big book, the Alfred Hitchcock Compendium. Pauline C. Smith writes our next story, and it's called A Flower in Her Hair. Well, while you're here, I suppose I better take you over to see Aunt Abby. Aunt Abby? Questioned the girl. Who's she? Well, she ain't really an aunt, but she's some relation. Melinda's voice trailed off as her memory attempted to locate the offshoot on the family tree that was Aunt Abby.
Well, now, being my second cousin, I guess she's pretty fur removed from you.
She gazed at her visitor uncertainly. Then her eyes turned resolute.
But she's blood kin, so you should see her.
Well, why? The girl was growing impatient of distant family ties woven to strangle her in this strange country of her mother's. Melinda bustled. Well, she's a record keeper. She's got second sight, too.
When do we have to go?
Tradition and folklore were losing their piquancy. Again, Melinda looked doubtfully upon the city-bred frailty of her guest.
Well, it's quite a piece. Rough ground. But I guess we better get over there today. You leaving so soon.
The girl sighed, mentally ticking off the hours left to her here. In the hot sun, she followed in a wake of Melinda's angular maturity, which plowed a furrow through weeds and thistle, over boulder-strewn hillside bare of trees and bristling with prickly growth that offered no protection from the beating heat. At last, Melinda turned to look at the girl behind her.
Well, we better stop and rest a while, I guess.
She eased her bulk down carefully, watching her companion slump to the ground.
Tired, ain't you?
The girl nodded.
I should have remembered you ain't used to this kind of country. Your face sure is flushed.
The girl thrust out a lower lip to blow cooling air across her cheeks.
You redhead sunburn, don't you?
Again, the girl nodded. Melinda turned reflective.
Don't know where that ever was, a redhead in the family before.
My father had auburn hair.
Oh, I never seen him. Your ma's hair was a black as a raven's wing.
Yeah, I remember. Melinda heaved herself to her broad feet.
Well, might as well get going if we want to get back by sundown.
Ain't fur now. She pointed. Just up the hill and over to the ridge.
See you in a little bit.
The cabin finally appeared in the distance, like a lookout on the rim. Staring curiously, the girl asked,
Is that it?
That's it. Ain't Abby's lived there for now going on 50 years.
Well, how old is she?
They had reached the summit. The cabin squatted beneath bowed trees that held hands over its roof.
Well, now she must be over 70 now. Spry, though. Spry as a chicken.
Melinda took a sidelong glance at her weary companion.
Climbs these hills like a mountain goat when she's a mind to.
The girl knew even a gentle thrust when she felt one. Her mouth tightened.
Well, she said flatly, I just hope she's spry enough to get me a nice cold drink of water.
She'll have grape juice. Always keeps a pitcher down in the cave. The girl paused to stare over the ridge and into the gorge below. She backed up, trembling.
Are you sure she's home? Ain't Abby?
Oh, sure. She don't go no place. Always busy, though. Melinda said with certainty as she stepped through a broken gate and up a path hemmed in by weed-choked flowers. The door was open. Melinda poked her head through.
Ain't Abby, she shrieked.
Behind her, the girl stumbled over a claw hammer at the sill. She kicked it aside and into the weeds.
Ain't Abby,
shouted Melinda again.
Yes, 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 I'm coming.
Erupting from the shadows, peering into the sunlight, Aunt Abby strained forward. As Melinda had said, she was spry as a taut steel spring. Her meager nose projected itself before her. Her dark eyes were lodestones and her mouth an iron bar.
Oh, it's you, Melinda. Who's that you got with you?
Melinda stepped aside to give the girl an abrupt shove into the room.
Well, this here's Maddie's girl. She's been stopping with us a couple of days.
Aunt Abby shifted relationships through her mind.
Marty's girl.
Inspecting her, she reached forth a claw-like hand with a feather touch. The girl drew minutely away.
Come in and sit down.
Sliding into the room, the girl backed to a chair, feeling the slick wooden arms of it with her fingertips. As she sat on the edge of the broken cane seat, Aunt Abby stood before her. Again the claws reached out.
Marty's girl. Such a pretty red hair.
Talons hovered over the girl's shining head, suspended there.
Such awful pretty red hair.
Aunt Abby turned to Melinda.
Did you ever see such pretty red hair?
Melinda shook her head.
Now, can't say I ever did. Guess I never seen any red hair in this family before. She said she got it from her pa.
The girl shrank, her eyes moving cautiously from Aunt Abby to the objects in the room, cluttered and stacked souvenirs, a chaos of remembrance.
She's thirsty, suggested Melinda.
Aunt Abby took another covetous look at the flaming hair.
Such a pretty red.
Yes, Melinda, I'll fetch some grape juice.
She scuttled from the room. The girl heard a door slam, quick staccato footsteps descending. The room grew brighter as her eyes adjusted.
So much stuff, she murmured.
Yeah, Aunt Abby keeps everything, Melinda explained proudly. All the family records, too. Them rugs, well, she made from relations' clothes.
As Melinda gestured with humble admiration, the girl looked down upon the oblongs, circles, hooks, and braided, crocheted and cross-stitched utilization of the rags of memory, placed in precision like an army, white pine boards between the battalions.
She made all them samplers, too.
The girl raised her eyes to stare at the walls with the exquisite needlework, each square of cloth threaded with a "May he rest in peace" or derivative.
When they die, explained Melinda, she stitches them up.
The girl shuddered, drowned in her own morbid fascination. Her eyes fixed themselves on the bright cloths of death.
I'll try to get Aunt Abby to show you the wreath, Melinda whispered,
her eyes rolling, her breast swelling beneath coarse cotton, her large, spare body quivering with anticipation. The girl offered no interest, intent only upon the sound of scrambling footsteps as they returned. Her every thought, every desire, was to get away from here, from the saffron face of Aunt Abby, her nimble tread, the heavy cup pushed so gently, ever so insidiously, into her hand. The girl sipped the cold, dark liquid.
Good, ain't it? Prodded Melinda.
She nodded with a faint smile, and a thread of purple parting her lips. Stiffly then, with eyes averted, she placed the cup half full on the marble top table at her side. Aunt Abby stood lightly on a hooked memorial watching her.
Your ma had black hair, she turned to Melinda. Remember how dark Marty's hair was?
Melinda nodded.
I thought maybe you'd show us your you-know-what.
Aunt Abby looked speculatively at the girl. She extended a hand, fingers curved, almost touching the bright hair.
I'll fetch it.
The girl was deep in the chair now, feeling the stiff, jagged ends of broken cane. Her stomach curled, streaks of cold hunched her shoulders. Sluggishly, she gazed out at the shaft of sunshine in the doorway.
Oh, the books of records, too,
called Melinda, leaning forward as Aunt Abby returned to squat before the girl. Carefully, Aunt Abby laid the large gilt frame on a braided rug. She opened a book on her knees.
That, explained Melinda, is the family record. The first part shows the Berthins, the last part the Dyans.
Aunt Abby flipped pages, her sepia fingers fondling the last of them, clean and unwritten.
How old are you, dear?
24.
Oh, just 24. Well, well, your ma lived to be, let's see.
She leafed back.
32. Your branch of the family always did go young. Your pa ain't in here. He wasn't kin.
Dad died last year.
Oh, you're all alone?
Yes.
Except for us.
The girl was hazily displeased with the tie-in.
No, I'm just passing through here, she said in a minor revolt, on my way home, to the coast, she added, feeling the necessity of identity, a longing for familiarity.
Well, 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 Aunt Abby crooned absently. Her mind seemed to wander as her eyes studied the girl.
Well, and she smiled, her lips sucking her teeth briskly.
So, do you want to see the wreath?
Wreath?
The hair wreath, Aunt Abby placed the book on the floor and picked up the oval gilt frame.
Its curves caught the beams of light from the doorway. She held it up against her knees, her fingers holding it in place. Steadily, she watched the girl. The girl stared down into a circlet of flowers, painstakingly woven against the linen background. Twined into the floral hoop bloomed the white of cherry blossoms, the gray of cactus spine, yellow daisies, brown iris, ashen lilies, goldenrod. Aunt Abby bent her head, her silver-colored claw pointing out a portion of the wreath.
See them? They are black-eyed Susans. The center comes straight from your ma's hair. Pretty, ain't they?
The finger caressed the glossy black.
My mother's hair?
The girl drew back, held her breath, and allowed her face to blank out in utter disbelief.
This here's made of hair, didn't you know?
The girl stared glassily at this incredible woman and her absurd handiwork. She felt the sharp gouge of broken cane in the hard rungs of the chair against her back.
It's got hair in it from every one of the family that's passed on.
Melinda hitched closer, tipping her head as she gazed proudly down upon the wreath.
Ain't it pretty now? Ain't it just elegant?
She shook her head with wonder.
And how she does it, I'll never know. All them fine hairs, the little bitty stitches, I would never have the patience.
You mean that's hair? The girl clung to the arms of the chair because there was substance, here reality.
Human hair? All of it?
Aunt Abby nodded, pleased.
Just the family, though,
she qualified with dignity.
I want never one to fool with any of that ain't kid.
All those people are dead? Rising, Aunt Abby leaned the frame against the table and stepped back to view it.
Well, that's how I keep 'em. It's kind of a memorial. Shows my respect, sort of.
The girl stared at her, then back to the wreath. Her lips stretched, her nostrils flared.
See?
Aunt Abby's long finger pointed.
I ain't got that rose in yet.
Reflectively, she gazed at the girl in the chair.
I just got the rose left.
The empty spot severed the circle like a break in a wedding ring. Outlines of rose petals had been sketched upon the linen.
It's all that's left. Once I get that in, the wreath'll be done.
The room began to swing. The wreath whirled concentrically, wreath within wreath, circle upon circle. Heat held the girl's body, chill released it. She placed an uncertain hand before her eyes.
I'm a little sick, she whispered weakly.
Attempting to rise, she stumbled and was caught in Melinda's strong but gentle grasp.
Well, she's a city girl, she faintly heard Melinda apologize. She ain't used to the walk we took. We'll lay her on your cot, Aunt Abby.
She felt herself half dragged, half carried through rolling blackness. Melinda stepped from the sleep room while Aunt Abby tarried to stroke the shining hair on the pillow. Melinda paused in thought.
She's a pretty sick girl. Too much sun, maybe. Her skin looks kind of green, don't it? Such pretty, pretty red hair, said Aunt Abby.
Could be, Melinda hesitated, absorbed now with a problem beset by it and confused.
Could be I best go home and get Tom to come back with the truck and fetch her.
She looked upon Aunt Abby for confirmation. She couldn't never walk through them hills again the way she is.
You do that.
Aunt Abby's decision was immediate and definite. She urged Melinda to the door, threw it and out into the sunshine.
There ain't no hurry, now. Don't, not a mite of it. I'll tend to the girl. You don't worry. Don't you worry on it. I'll see she gets a nice long sleep.
Without a single backward glance, Melinda walked over the boulders in the setting sun. Familiar with Aunt Abby's competent hands and second sight, she felt a sense of accomplishment. Hadn't Aunt Abby cured old Opal of the jumps and predicted the death of little Junie May? Nobody believed her that time, the baby being so fat and rosy-like, but lo and behold, Junie May died like that. Melinda, in recollection, chopped the air out with her hand. The child's hair turned into the brightest yellow buttercups of them all. When Tom arrived at near dark, Melinda told him, "There ain't no rush and hurry. Aunt Abby'll take care of the girl good. It's best we don't unsettle her rest tonight. We'll fetch her first thing in the morning, though, so she can catch her train." At daybreak, Melinda was pleased to relax on the seat of the truck. She spread her dress down over her thighs and leaned back against the wooden brace. The trip to Aunt Abby's didn't take long this way, through dust-streaked fennel and the cool, clear dawn. "We'll fetch her right back home so she can pack up. It sure makes a girl puny to raise her up in a city. You wouldn't think a bit of a walk like that could get her to ailing now, would you? She is a sweet little thing, though, even if she ain't healthy. I've growed real fond on her." Aunt Abby's cabin crouched in the shadow of the trees, a dreary and slumlined recluse. Melinda walked around to the open door. She kicked a hammer from the sill into the weeds and bent over to pick up a pocket mirror from the warped floor. Inside, Aunt Abby formed a pale sickle of absorption in the shadows, intent on her needle, the gilt frame propped before her.
"Well, now, how is she?" called Melinda.
Aunt Abby turned slowly to peer through the gloom.
"How's who?" "Why, Marty's girl, Aunt Abby. She got to ailing while she was visiting yesterday. Remember?"
Aunt Abby's mind seemed to reach back into all the yesterdays where it groped, fumbled, poked, and pried.
"Oh, the redhead!"
She turned back to her work and, with great care, slid her needle into the linen, the copper-red strand glinting against the half-finished rose.
"Well, now, Melinda, did I tell you I seen death on that girl?"
Melinda clutched her heart and knew with sudden terror. Then she rocked back to awe and veneration.
You seen that, Aunt Abby? Like you seen it with Junie May?"
Melinda was hypnotized by the shine of a wondrous second sight.
"Just the same," said Aunt Abby, nodding. "Just the same,"
and took another stitch.
You mean she's dead now, Aunt Abby?" "She's dead now."
Aunt Abby's words impaled Melinda's mind to send her glance slant-eyed around the shadows of the room, searching out yet sliding from the girl's departed soul. It was then Melinda discovered the mirror in her hand, the mirror she had found on the porch. With reverence, she placed it clear as a circular pond upon the marble-topped table. She felt a moment's sharp grief for Marty's girl, quickly followed by respect for Aunt Abby's ever-accurate prognostications. Melinda's breast was full of sorrow, and it almost burst with pride. With humility, Melinda took a step closer to the wreath. The rose had begun to take form, bright and shining under Aunt Abby's able fingers.
"Where is she?" asked Melinda in hushed tones. "Did you lay her out on your cot, Aunt Abby?" "Well, now, she went walking to death, Melinda."
Aunt Abby turned from her work and pierced Melinda with eyes that held the gift of knowledge.
"Some folks do that, Melinda. They go walking out to meet their death. Marty's girl went out to meet hers and tumbled right over into the gorge." Melinda could see it. The girl with outstretched arms, the gorge a black and yawning mouth.
"She's there now?" Melinda asked.
"Right down in the gorge, a broken flower." Aunt Abby returned to the wreath.
Melinda watched the bright hair snake through linen. She was fully aware that Aunt Abby never snipped a live lock. Never. How many times had she observed? How many times has she watched Aunt Abby's assistance to the dying? The mirror held patiently near to parted lips until no further fog clouded the surface. Then came the slash of scissors, and an aster grew upon the wreath, a russet chrysanthemum. Now, a rose. Melinda's sorrowful, pride-filled mind knew perplexity. If Marty's girl had walked to death, had toppled over the rim and dropped deep into the gorge to meet it, how had Aunt Abby gone through the rites, those never-changing rites of the mirror, the slash of blades, and the lock of hair? Melinda retreated a reluctant step. How? Melinda's mind groped for understanding through its fog of indecision. Aunt Abby was spry, spry as a mountain goat, but Melinda hadn't known she was spry enough to swing up the sheer face of the gorge with scissors, hair and a mirror in her hand. Melinda heaved a final sigh of acceptance. She guessed she was, though. Aunt Abby, with her second sight and her talent for keeping the record, could do most anything, Melinda guessed.
"It's a mighty pretty rose," she said at last. "Mighty pretty. And ain't it red?"
Well, my friends, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour. Keith Tyler saying thanks for tuning in and joining me again next time, if you would honor me, please. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.